Welcome to KUOW's Speakers Forum. I'm your host, John O'Brien. In this week's episode, we'll hear from a variety of speakers who went to the StoryCorps booth in Seattle's New Holly neighborhood last summer to interview friends and family about important milestones in their lives. You'll hear a mayoral love story, one of the activists who disrupted the Bernie Sanders rally last summer, from the mother and partner of a man who faced death bravely and with style, from an NAACP leader who spent 22 years in prison before he was granted clemency, from two Japanese-American siblings and their experience of Richland, Washington after World War II, a mother and daughter on their fateful open adoption, and how a day-long trip to pick berries on Vashon Island expanded a boy's consciousness of race, class, and community. We begin with the man who would be mayor's love story.
My name is Ed Murray. I am 60 years old, which is amazing to me. And I am with my husband, Michael Shiozaki.
Hi, I'm Michael Shiozaki, and I'm 54 years old, and I am married to Ed Murray.
So yesterday, we celebrated our 24th anniversary of the day we met and the second anniversary of our legal marriage. And it has been quite a journey.
So it has been quite a journey. I think when we met 24 years ago, I never would have guessed this is where life would lead us, that today we'd be married and you'd be mayor and I'd be first gentleman, as I'm referred to. I mean, it has been an amazing journey. When we met at Mount Rainier,
because mutual friends invited us on a hiking and camping trip at Itsip Creek, which is the Carbon Glacier area of Mount Rainier. I knew them through church. There used to be a LGBT mass at the Catholic Church at St. Joseph's before we were tossed out. And you knew them through work. And so they invited us both separately. And they were very interested in me meeting somebody else they knew. And I saw you, and I was very interested in finding out who you were.
And I do remember that meeting in the campground on that sunny August day. And I remember the hikes up to, it was Natural Bridge, I think, was the hike we went up to on that misty day.
So I knew you were interested when we got to the top. And in the mist, and you offered me peanut M&Ms, and you were a little nervous when you made the offer, so I thought, oh, there might be some energy here.
And then that's true. I was a little nervous. I really didn't know you at all and really hadn't had a chance to really talk with you since I hiked up the mountain with Kevin and you hiked up the mountain with Bob.
And then on the way back down, I asked you if you had a tent. You said no, but Kevin and Bob were going to provide you a tent. I said, my tent sleeps three people. You said, never mind.
Because I thought it was a setup. But
somehow, nothing happened, but we did spend the night together in that tent. And then I had to leave the next day, and I left you a note.
You left me a note, that's right, inviting me to see the movie Paris is Burning the next week. And so I think I called you. Did I call you the very next day?
Yeah, Monday.
That next Monday to go out on a date. And the one thing I do remember, though, is that you put me on hold. I couldn't believe it. Oh, my God, he put me on hold.
Because there were people in my office, and I thought, wow, he called Monday, so let me get these people out of the office. And so then we started dating.
And I think you realize that you're not linear. I'm very linear. You're much more a stream of consciousness. You're kind of all over the place. And I think one of the ways that it's demonstrated in your life is that, you know, you're the one that reads eight books all at once, which is something I could never do, where I need to read the book and finish it. So I am truly the linear one, but you truly are not.
The first thing that struck me when I saw Michael was how handsome he is. With his black hair and his olive complexion and his really athletic body, he is incredibly gracious and even in his approach to things that life has tossed at us. So what attracted you to me? I forgot that since so long.
I think you know. You know, it was, you know, that red hair that, you know, is a little less obvious today. That red hair, I think, you know, you're just kind of the ease of conversation. I could tell you were a very deep and thoughtful person from the first conversations that we had, either on the first or second date.
So, in other words, Michael brings a lot of stability and calm into my life, and I bring a lot of chaos and excitement into his.
I'd say that sums that up pretty well.
Yeah.
Mayor Ed Murray and First Gentleman Michael Shiasaki had that conversation at the StoryCorps booth in New Holly. Last August 2015, two Black Lives Matter activists took over the stage from Democratic presidential candidate Bernie Sanders at a rally in Westlake Park. Marissa Johnson and Mara Williford's action provoked a huge debate around the country. In this interview with Amir Islam, Mara Williford describes Black Lives Matter and why the group chose to take the podium that day.
For those who don't know about Black Lives Matter and the movement, could you give me some background about that?
Yeah. So Black Lives Matter is a network with over 26 chapters across the U.S. and in Canada.
Wow.
We do organizing around Black liberation, and we believe that anti-Blackness, it's a global system that is foundational to other forms of oppression like capitalism and other forms of racism. I'd say the movement overall is really decentralized, but it's definitely expanding.
And so, dun, 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 the million-dollar question, Bernie Sanders. Weekend at Bernie's. Could you talk about the incident?
Yeah, I'll try and do the condensed version. So even with, like, the five people that I was standing with mm-hmm. at the rally, because we were there for, what, 3 hours or whatever, that mm-hmm. people were blah, 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 whoop, 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 talking mm-hmm. during the main part of the rally. Here I am with, like, you know, a couple other young Black folks, and we're standing there in the audience, and we stick out amongst all these, like, 60-plus-year-old white folks. Like, we stuck out like a sore thumb, so we had all kinds of people coming up to us. We had security following us around.
Yeah.
And you know what I mean? They were really on edge. We didn't want them to...
Security
to tighten up. We didn't want Bernie to not even come onto stage because they already knew or whatever. Yeah. And so it was important to be low-key.
Right.
Standing there, and I'm like, okay, we're going to get over this barricade.
Right.
Then I see Gerald Hankerson of the NAACP. I see Gerald, and I'm like, Gerald,
right.
I'm thirsty. Bring me some water.
Right.
So he's on the other side, like where the media tent is. Mm-hmm. He's on the other side of the barricades. He, like, gets a bottle of water, brings it over to me, and we start chatting. He's like, are you going to do something? And, you know, so he and I are chatting, and then, you know, I'm like, we gotta get on the other side of these barricades because homegirl's on the other side and she has to make, and he's looking at me like, girl, I don't even know what you're talking about, but just come over. So he lifts up the barricade and lets me and Jazz through.
Right.
So me and Jazz are just standing there chilling next to Gerald, who had spoke earlier that day.
Right.
And three of us are standing there and security starts coming.
Right.
Security starts lining up in front of us. And so then I get nose to nose with them. And I'm like, whatever, conversating with them. And I'm a little distracted. So by the time I was nervous, too. So I was kind of out of it. And I blink. And Bernie Sanders is already up at the podium.
Right.
So I'm like, I got to go now. And these security guards, they're like shoulder to shoulder. They like have their arms crossed. They're like they have a solid wall. I just go under their legs or whatever and just. And I get up there and Marissa's not there.
No.
And so I literally panic, had no idea what to do. So I just, like, strike a power pose, put my fist in the air like John Carlos said.
Yeah, I just put my fist in the air
because I have no idea what to do. So I'm just like, I'm going to just.
There was that awkward fist. I saw that.
Yes. I was like, I'm just going to hold space, right? And then from behind me, I hear Bernie Sanders says, thank you, Seattle, for being the most progressive city in America.
Right.
I'm like, man, fuck this guy. Like, you know, blah, blah, blah. He's like, blah, 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 whoop, whoop, whoop. And then Marissa, I hear her voice say, Black Lives Matter
right,
in the distance.
Right.
And I turn around and my ass is on that stage,
yes,
like in an instant. So then we were both at the podium,
yeah,
nose to nose with Bernie.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh my God, we just did this thing. It was a lot of planning that went into just getting us that far, getting us on the stage.
Mm-hmm.
But then as soon as we were on the stage, the pressure was on,
mm-hmm,
right? Because one, there was all these guys,
mm-hmm,
security guards, Bernie staffers, whatever. There was
right,
all these guys on the stage,
mm-hmm,
who were trying to get us to sit down and shut up.
Right, right.
And
right,
they were all manhandling us and everything. And they're like big enough, they can just pick us up and move us.
Right.
You know what I mean? So I know. And the thing is, I knew that I wasn't going to be doing the talking. Marissa was going to do the talking.
Mm-hmm.
So I felt like I really needed to be more aggressive and make sure that she got the mic. I don't know what they were on. They were trying to do this like negotiation with us. And there's no negotiating. I literally, the first thing I say, the mic is like at the podium and one of Bernie's staffers is talking. So I just lean in over him and speak into the mic. And I'm like, you're going to let her speak right now or we're shutting it down.
Right.
And they thought I was kidding.
Right.
I wasn't kidding. You know what I mean?
I don't know how they
So then they told us, they immediately told us that we could speak after Bernie. But that's not even the issue. The issue is it's not your stage anymore.
Yeah.
You're not negotiating with me. We're not compromising on anything. This is my stage. Me and Marissa had already decided,
mm-hmm,
what we were going to do with that time, that Bernie had lost that platform and did not deserve that platform. And we had decided that we were going to highlight the state of emergency that Black people are in this country. And so when they were trying to like negotiate with me, and like even when she was talking, they were still in my ear trying to like, you know, figure out when is she going to be done, and like, okay, after this she has to end, like it's getting too long, blah blah blah. And you can tell on the video I'm not even listening. I have one hand on the podium like it's a throne, one hand on my hip, and I'm staring straight into that angry ass crowd. I'm not even paying attention to them talking to me. There's one time where they're like right in my ear and like one of my braids like falls in my face and I just like flick my hair back.
Right.
But I'm still like, I'm literally just mean mugging into the crowd.
Right.
And, you know, we did so much mental, emotional, spiritual prep before the action because we knew it was going to be controversial. We knew it was going to be a really hostile environment. But there's really nothing that can prepare you for what it actually feels like to have thousands of white people yelling at you, especially during that moment, that 4.5 minute moment of silence for Mike Brown, the day before the anniversary of his death. I put my fist up and I closed my eyes and I told Marissa, hold my hand.
Mm.
And we stood there and like, we're holding hands so I can like hear her breath caught in her body. I can like feel her shaking and crying. And I can just hear all those white folks just like booing and it just felt like being at a sit-in. It was really wild. You know, we really weren't surprised from the response from the crowd. We did expect them to be really hostile, and we did realize that what we were doing was going to be really controversial. I don't think you can emotionally prepare enough for like how that feels like, but mentally we knew that that was probably what was going to happen, was the response that we got from the crowd, that liberals would all of a sudden not look so progressive when they were being called out or when they were being inconvenienced. We knew it would make national news, but we didn't realize that it would really like put a shockwave through the nation. And I think a lot of it was that visual of this like privileged white man that's like had power in office for a long time, like this older white man, like having him be up there and having me and Marissa, who are very young, you know, at the time unknown nationally and are super femme with colors in our hair. I think the visual of having young women demand power and take that platform from him like that, I think had a very visceral response from the whole country. We did not realize that it would strike a chord with people like that. It's never been about Bernie, so we never were really worried about how he would respond.
Wait, it was never about Bernie.
Let me say that again. I'll say that again for the people in the back.
Bernie,
it was
right.
never about Bernie. Still isn't about Bernie.
But what about his politics?
Still don't care. Oh,
he marched with King.
Right. Well, I could write a whole novel about his imperialist, racist ass, xenophobic politics. There's a million things about his politics that are all wrong and not.
But he's the best thing you people
but,
will
right,
ever
but
have.
He's our best option, right?
People will never have anybody better.
Right. We're actually just sheep, and we need the Democrats to, we need to allow them to corral us, because otherwise they'll feed us to the wolves, the Republicans. Mm. Yeah. No, I'm not buying it. I think.
So if it wasn't about Bernie, what was it about?
It was about the fact that here's this platform that exists, and any platform that exists in this country should be used to address the state of emergency that Black lives are in. It wasn't ever about trying to get Bernie to do one thing or the other, because we're never going to get free because of just one candidate. Mm-hmm. I actually don't really care what any one candidate is doing so much, because I'm focused on Black people, mm-hmm. and on our liberation. We were, pleasantly surprised, I suppose, by the response from him, and that he did make a lot of changes. He did, he now is talking about race. And so I think it does push other candidates to do the same, like we really did push the bar. And I don't give him any credit for the changes that he's implemented, and I don't give the Democrats any credit for the changes that they've implemented, like the Democratic National Convention. They voted to support Black Lives Matter, and now I don't care.
Well,
I mean,
they have, huh?
Right. So I wonder, like, how that happened.
You keep shutting them down,
right?
And things and
I wonder how that happened. So I don't give them credit for that at all. But me and Marissa and the rest of our comrades in other cities that are confronting, we can acknowledge that as a victory. It's not going to lead to freedom, but it shows that we got people's attention.
Mara Williford and Amir Islam were recorded at the StoryCorps booth in Seattle's New Holly neighborhood last summer. The next conversation concerns a dying man's last wishes, as recalled by his mother and his partner.
My name is Dorothy Bullitt. I am 59 years old, and my relationship to Mary Merriweather she is my friend, and she is the mother of my late partner, Patrick Burr.
My name is Mary Merriweather. I'm 79 years old. And Dorothy Bullitt is a very good friend of mine. She was a girlfriend to my dead son from high school. They were friends from high school. Patrick died from prostate cancer. And he died because he didn't have any medical insurance. And so he didn't catch it early. Mm-hmm. And then he suffered so much at the end. Even though he was under the care of hospice, he had a terrible death. And I watched it. I mean, I was there with him, and it was just so painful.
Throughout that time, you were enjoying music, and you both loved to dance and to sing.
Oh.
And even when he was so sick, he was singing and dancing and laughing.
Right. We had this little thing. We never talked about it, but I would say something, and then it might be the words to a song, and then he would start singing the song. For instance, there was one day when the nurse came to change the catheter, mm-hmm. in the bag. Mm-hmm. And so after the nurse left and I was sitting in the living room, he came walking down the hall and he was singing and patting on the bag, and he was singing, "Papa's got a brand new bag." And that was the way he was. That was the humor, And so where it was hard times, he kept me laughing. We had a lot. We laughed about a lot. And then it was the day with you in the dress.
Oh,
that
yeah.
I was there.
The Cinderella dress.
Right.
When he was holding me around my waist. And we were been listening to music. And he felt my waist and said, "I think you could fit into my Cinderella dress." "Your Cinderella dress?" He said, "Yes. When I was 28, and he was 58, when I was 28, I found this dress in an antique store, and I thought, I want to buy that dress. And one day, a woman will fit it, and she will be my Cinderella. And many women tried, and no one fitted it. Right. And so he got up, and he walked across the room with his catheter bag on the and the pole, and he pulled out of his teeny little closet a bag covering a dress, and he said, go into the bathroom and try it on. And I'm thinking, oh, no, I'm 56 years old. This is not going to have a good outcome. And then I came out, and it fit perfectly.
Right. And I just couldn't believe it.
And that he said, and he says, Dorothy, when you preside at my funeral, yes, I want you to wear this dress. And I said, a black sequined beaded cocktail dress? Isn't that going to be a bit much for your funeral? And he said, it's a black funeral. You can't overdress. He said, but there may be women in the audience who have tried that dress on.
Right.
And I remember when I talked about it in the funeral.
At the funeral,
and,
right.
And his wife or his partner, former partner, yeah, jumped up and said, I wore that dress. And he was so just full of romantic gestures and playfulness, even right, as he was so very sick. And having rekindled that relationship, he was so different, and the life he'd lived was so different from the men that I had been with or had expected to be with. And one thing I learned is being with a man who really loves his mother and really likes his mother and really enjoys his mother's humor and her company, that is a great, great recipe for a partner.
That was Dorothy Bullitt and Mary Merriweather speaking at the StoryCorps booth in Seattle. In 1987, Gerald Hankerson was convicted of aggravated murder. After 22 years behind bars, Governor Christine Gregoire commuted his life sentence. He had been convicted on the testimony of his co-defendant, a man who later admitted he had lied. Today, Hankerson is president of the NAACP's Seattle-King County branch and the three-state conference overseeing Alaska, Oregon, and Washington. Hankerson told Rachel DeCruz about the day of his release.
I'm the first man in the history of the state to ever walk out of prison after being sentenced to, for the rest of his life.
Tell me what you felt like on that day.
Oh, man, this is going to take a little longer. Man, you're going to need a couple extra minutes for this, because this was the big one. This is the one that, you know, I remember that I was sitting down at the table with my friend Barry Massey, who's the youngest man that's ever been convicted in the nation. He's finally coming home in February, by the way. Barry Massey.
That's fantastic. And
he's coming home in February. And, of course, we're sitting there, and my counselor come and tell me, she says, Gerald, you can't go to yard because it's workout time. It's like the superintendent want to see you. And I was like, come on, man. Every time this happened, that means pack my bags and I'm out of here again. So I done actually started saying my byes to people. I went to my room. I grabbed my phone book. I gave a message to say, man, call my family, my number, just in case. I don't know what's about to happen. I know what that transition is about to be. No communication, no nothing. And they came and escorted me out to the office. He made all the guards get out of the office, comes in. He's sitting at the desk, and he got this yellow piece of paper and pink paper rolled up in his hand. And he says, Gerald, have a seat. And I've known him for years, even when he became a regular cop, an officer, moved up through the ranks at Monroe back when all this other stuff happened. So I was, Pat Gleeby is his name. And I was like, I'm not sitting down, Gleeby. But I know I'm used to this routine by now, man. Just what I do this time and where am I headed? And he's like, sit down. I was like, no, we had this debate. And I said, I'm looking at the goldenrod paper in the back of your hand. That means the signature that signs me off to intensive management unit. And he just said, Gerald, I just want to be the first person that says you're a free man. And he rolled out my agreement signed by Governor Gregoire to grant me my clemency. And I'm just stunned. I sat down in a chair. And there were some books that was on the table that I knocked down. There was this phone in the middle of the table. And this is on April 9th, 2009. And he slides it to me and he says, call whoever you want. And I was like, I had to call my lawyer, Cheryl McLeod, who 2-3 years ago became the newest Supreme Court judge in Washington State. That's Gold Cheryl, that's my girl. And as soon as I dialed that number, she said, Gerald, are you sitting down? I said, listen, I go through this again. I already know, attorney. And she was, her whole office, you can hear me in the background screaming. She said, now what does it mean? I said, I don't know. Let's ask him. And when I handed him the phone, they were talking, and that's the first time I heard him say, Oh, no, no, no. We're not going through a process. I'm walking Gerald out of here tonight. And I say, let's go. He said, man, go pack your stuff, do all the stuff, the process. You know, people got to come take pictures and all of that. It was yard in, everybody now coming back. He actually had to lock the prison down to walk me out of there because the whole prison had heard. Mm-hmm. And because too many, I mean, hugs and oh, my God.
Yeah.
And he said, get out of here for the news come and sent me on my way. But ultimately, and my first call, the first call I got on my cell phone, on a cell phone that I've never seen in 20-some years,
yeah.
Last one was the size of suitcases. Now they got these little hand things. And there was Senator Debbie Rigala, retired from the Washington State Senate last couple of years ago. But she's welcome home. I mean, it was a beautiful moment, beautiful moment, a beautiful moment.
Today, Gerald Hankerson is president of both the NAACP's Seattle-King County branch and the three-state conference overseeing Alaska, Oregon, and Washington. Here's another conversation from the StoryCorps booth in Seattle's New Holly neighborhood.
My name is David Coe. I am 63 years old. My relationship to the other person is sibling. She is my sister.
And I'm Karen Coe. I'm 65, and I'm here with my brother.
So what we thought would be most interesting would be to talk about our growing up in Richland, Washington, the Atomic City.
Our parents, Roy and Alice, came to Richland. I think it was 1948. And Richland was created during World War II as the city that housed all of the workers who were at Hanford in the various reactors out there who were developing the plutonium for the war effort. So the bombs that were dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, ironically, because we are Japanese Americans and because Mom and Dad had both been put into concentration camps during World War II. So the fact that they, you know, came out of those camps, went to college, and then ended up in Richland at this site that was making this stuff was kind of, I don't know, ironic. I don't know if Mom and Dad thought it was very ironic.
Yeah, we were talking about that last night, whether or not it was part of the conscious decision to come to Richland for them. And he graduated in chemistry and in Minnesota. I think the consciousness was more, this is a great opportunity, let's move out there and raise our family.
I think at the time when we were growing up, in fact, that Richland had, like, I don't know, an incredibly high percentage of PhDs in the per capita or something. It was, like, ridiculous. Also had a really high percentage of white people. I mean, it was a really white community. In high school, I remember thinking about the fact that, well, you know, there's our family. We're the Japanese-American family in town. And then there's the Chins, who were the Chinese family in town who owned the Chinese restaurant. And then there was
a Hawaiian family. There was an
African-American family.
That was Earl Hall and Emmett Jackson. So there was one African-American family.
Right. For a long time when I was young, I thought that all Japanese-American people lived in California because we go every year down to California to see moms, you know, our aunts and uncles and cousins. And there were lots of Japanese-American people in California. I thought, wow, this is a cool state.
My experience was a little different in that I didn't really think about race much growing up there. It became more apparent to me when I went away to college.
I realized when I got to college and was thinking about and sort of like was studying race and the whole business around the incarceration of the Japanese during World War II. It's just so infuriating.
And then just thinking about the way that I felt like our family and me and our family that I really needed to sort of prove to everybody in Richland that we were as white as they were, you know, that we were as good as everybody else. And I was remember when I was in grade school. I'm not sure what grade exactly, but and this kid came out on the playground and called me a dirty Jap one day, and I don't know why. I don't. I was probably, you know, tougher than him or something, but I went running home and it was like really upset, and I don't know why I was so upset, because I wasn't familiar with the term, so I didn't know exactly what it meant, but it was just that there was so much sort of hostility in his voice when he said that, that it just made me feel bad, so I ran home and I told Mom. And Mom gave me the, you know, you be proud of being Japanese lecture, and proud of being part of our family, and that I always needed to, like make the family proud, and you know.
I remember that too. Yeah, make the family proud. I remember less of being proud of being Japanese, but just. More proud of being part of this family, because we didn't have a lot of cultural things. We didn't speak Japanese at home. When we did, when we observed any traditions or had any traditional food, it was down with relatives in California that I remember.
Until the Japanese man came once a month in Richland, when the truck would come from Seattle full of. Probably got everything from a Wajimaya, but had all of these great, you know, Japanese food, and this guy would make stops in the little towns, and then he would come to Richland and pull into our driveway, and like all the kids in the neighborhood would come down to check it out because it was so cool.
Yeah, I have memories of that too. In that one of my favorite things that he would bring. Were those, they're like a little jellied candy that you can eat the paper.
Yeah.
Yeah, you could eat the paper, and then there was a little prize that was in the box. So that was a big deal.
Siblings David and Karen Coe remembered growing up in Richland, Washington after World War II. They recorded their conversation at StoryCorps in Seattle's New Holly neighborhood last summer. Here's another family story.
Hello, my name is Kayla. I am 26 years old, and my interviewer is my mother, Mary Lou.
And I'm Mary Lou Balison. I'm 57, and I'm going to be asking my daughter questions. So today we came to talk about how our family was formed, which is a little different. Kayla was adopted. Kayla and her brother are both adopted, and it was a special kind of adoption called foster care adoption. And foster care adoption means that a child comes to live with a foster parent that is willing to adopt them if they become legally free.
So, Mom, what made you decide you wanted to adopt kids?
I did want to have children in my life. I wasn't married. Didn't look like I was going to get married anytime soon. And I thought, I don't want to have birth children that I bring into this world when there's so many kids that need a family. And I also wanted to support what I thought was a better way for foster care.
Now, you adopted Dustin and I together. Did you think you would have more than one child before we both came along?
No. So I often would tease people and say, you know, really, you shouldn't be outnumbered by the number of kids you have. So if you're a single parent, two is probably a little more difficult. Well, luckily for me, you and Dustin were the first ones they called about. And of course I said, oh, yeah. Because the first time you came with me, I thought it was just going to be for the weekend. And I got the call on Thursday, and I came and picked you up on Friday, you and Dustin up on Friday at the Department of Social and Health Services. Do you remember that?
I do remember. I remember feeling very shy and unsure why we were moving from home to home, but I also felt the need to impress you so that hopefully I would stay with you. Mm-hmm. I was 4.5 years old when this first happened.
And Dustin was 18 months. And I have a very clear memory of coming to pick you guys up because you were playing on this little slide thing. And you both were the cutest little things with your blonde hair and your cute little cheeks. And I have to say, at that very first moment, I thought, oh, these are my Balasone kids. In that time, how did you understand what was happening to you and Dustin?
I don't think I really understood what it meant until I was in about middle school. I think I just kept repeating what the adults around me were telling me. It took me, you know, many years to figure out really what foster care and adoption was, even after I was adopted. And when I came to realize that, it still took me years to process what was wrong with the life Dustin and I had before entering foster care. You know, I think I felt like it was normal or okay to be abusive towards children, and I don't think I totally understood, you know, why. Because, of course, she told me all the time, you know, that she loved me and everything like that. And I guess I didn't realize that actions and words are very different things at that young age, and that it takes a lot more than just loving somebody to be a parent to somebody. Those separate things, you know, because it's very separate. You know, loving somebody and being able to take care of them are very different. And I don't think I really knew what that meant until that. You remember that project I did where I had to take care of that baby in middle school in eighth grade? And I failed it the first time around because I didn't wake up when it would cry in the middle of the night. And so I had to do the project and keep that baby all over again. I think that was the first time I really realized that it took more than just wanting to be a parent and having a child to be a parent.
It's interesting that you felt like you weren't loved by her because I think she showed most of her attention to you. And I don't know if I've ever told you this, but about a year into you living with me, Annette approached her social worker and said that she was willing to let me adopt Dustin, but that she wanted you back.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Okay, I'm sorry. I probably should have told you this before we started. Do you want me to change the subject?
No, it's okay.
But I said no. And I said no because Dustin was the person that had been in your life the longest.
And he's my best friend.
And, you know, you used to kind of take care of him when he was a little boy. And, you know, he had some hard times, too, because it wasn't a good situation for him.
I have no idea how grateful I am that you said no. Because we probably wouldn't have been together.
Yeah, and it's hard. It's, you know, sometimes people ask me would I do it again, and I'm like, I can't imagine my life without my children. Of course I would do it again. It's like when the judge asked me, do you understand what you're taking on? I'm like, well, yeah. This is my family. These are my kids. And I'm glad we did this today.
Me too.
Yeah, because it's some things we hadn't talked about before. Some things we have.
Some things we have.
Yeah.
Love you, Mom.
Love you, sweetie.
Mary Lou Balasone spoke to her daughter, Kayla, about her open adoption. Here's our final story, recorded at the StoryCorps booth at New Holly in Seattle.
My name is Lala Andrea Seguro. I am 22 years old, and I'm here with my dad, Nemo.
Yeah, I'm Nemo Seguro. I'm 52 years old. I was born in Seattle, Washington, and just sharing a story about my childhood with my daughter. Back when I was young, and Boeing was where your grandmother went to work straight out of high school. She worked in the factory there, and there was a big layoff. And there was actually a big billboard up that said, last person leaving Seattle, please turn out the lights. People were going through some pretty hard times. And your grandmother went through some retraining, and she ended up landing a job at the Veterans Administration in downtown. So we were pretty excited, like she got a job, and finally we're going to see some money rolling in. But things were really tight. And my mother had never worked in an office before, and she went to work one day. Everybody said, "Wait, we're going to take a coworker out for her birthday." My mother was like, "Oh, okay," and sort of went along and didn't realize that she wasn't just responsible for her own lunch, but also the part of the lunch for the birthday girl and part of the present and the card and everything. Her boss said, "Oh, it's okay, just write me a check," which my mother, too embarrassed to say what her situation was, ended up writing the check. So that afternoon, she snuck into a conference room and made some calls. She had seen kids downtown that were going off to pick berries off on the islands. So she came home that night and said, "Look, you got to be downtown, down in Pioneer Square at like 7 in the morning, and you go off, and it's going to be great. There's going to be all these other kids around, and they're going to give you a lunch." So next day, I woke up. I was used to, you know, getting up early. I walked, you know, the length of the hill down through Chinatown, made it to Pioneer Square, and showed up at the place I was supposed to be at, 2nd and Yesler, next to the Smith Tower. You can't miss it, but there's no kids there. There's a bunch of these Indian guys hanging out.
How old were you?
Maybe 5th grade. I'd already been coached on what to say, how old I was, because I was too young. So while we're waiting there, these guys are all talking, and some more Indians show up, Indian families, you know, and with some small kids. They were like asking, "What are you doing here?" And I said, "I'm going to pick berries." They said, "Okay, we'll just, you know, follow our lead," kind of thing. They warned me, "These guys are really mean. Don't talk on the bus. Don't talk unless you're spoken to." So we were all lined up, and this old jalopy of a school bus pulled up. And so everybody, but they got to me, this only white face in the crowd, is like, asked me how old I was, and I lied. And, you know, "Well, what grade are you in?" Because they didn't believe me, and I lied. "And what year were you born?" And lied again. And this one woman spoke up, said, "You know, I'm friends with this mom," just mentioned some name that she, you know, I just nodded in agreement, and, you know, was like, "He's with us," kind of thing. And so, you know, "Have you ever picked before?" And I was like, "Yeah," and I really never had. So we get on this bus. Everything was quiet, like they had warned me, like, "There's no talking. These guys are mean. They want silence," you know. And this was a sort of joyous group, laughing, joking, kids making a little noise. But when we got on the bus, everyone was quiet. We drove across West Seattle. We went down to the Fauntleroy Ferry. I was kind of excited. I didn't get a ride on the ferry but a few times in my life up to that point. So we took the ferry over and got the Vashon. And then we end up in this field, and they open the doors, and, like, everybody out. We start getting out. They start handing us big wood flats. And I could only carry, like, one or two. They show me where my row is, and I started picking. And I was, it's not easy, especially when you're a kid. You think with the little hands you'd be good at it. But I was hungry. The sun was starting to come up. And so a few of the berries would go into the containers inside the wood flat. And a few would go in my mouth, and then, you know, a few more in the, and then pretty soon they're going right into my mouth. And I, all of a sudden, I get hit by a rock, a small rock. And I looked around, and this older Indian guy, he shook his head at me. And I knew he meant don't eat the berries, so I continued picking. But when he wasn't looking, I started eating again. I didn't know he had seen me, and he kind of crouched, and he scooted over, like watching for the overseer, to make sure he didn't get caught. But he came over to me, and he picked up a few pebbles. He put them in his mouth, swished them around his mouth, and he spit out the dirt. And he said, "See?" And then he hands me these pebbles. So I pop in my mouth, and I wanted to immediately spit them out, but I ended up, you know, following his lead, and I split out this dirty saliva. And he said, he goes, "That will help with the hunger and with the thirst." And then the overseer sees, and he yells at him, "Hey, what are you doing?" He's, "I'm just showing this kid how to pick the good ones, boss." He'd give me encouraging looks, and he was a fast picker, and he had already gone off to get more flats. And I don't even think I got through one flat when they yelled out, you know, "It's lunch," right? And I'm like, awesome, right? Lunch. And, you know, I spit out these stones and make my way over to the bus, and I'm like, all the just Indian people, they went off into this grove where the little ones were being watched, and I'm looking around for where's the lunch,
And I see them like breaking out food, like breaking out bread and ripping off hunks and passing around water. And there's no lunch being provided. It's whatever they're able to pull out. I kind of went over and found a shady tree. They were sitting in the grass in the shade, and I went off to the side. And they're like, hey, you know, they start calling me over, come on over. It's really embarrassed, but I went over there, and they welcomed me into the circle, and they handed me something to drink and gave me food and, you know, make sure he gets some of that. And they started asking me, you know, what are you doing here? And you know, this was like the worst place, you know, to pick. And I didn't realize that when my mother had been calling around, you know, your grandmother now, she's older, a little scatterbrained, but she totally like blew it. She, instead of tossing this particular company, she, for some weird reason, that's the one she gave me, and all the other ones I didn't go to with the, you know, with the lunch and the kids and the fun, as they promised her on the phone. But ended up with these people, and we're just sitting around. And so it turned out I was at a farm where people were coming out of homeless shelters and people that were sleeping on the streets, that this was one of the places that would take them, but they were paying them less for each flat than you'd get at the other farms because they could do that to them and they could treat them poorly and yell at them.
Do you remember what your response was when you found that out?
I freaked out because I realized, you know, I had barely picked any, and I got real upset. And a woman, it was the same woman who sort of took me under at the, when we were downtown, and it was like, what's wrong? And I said, I need so much money. I need to pick so many flats. And now I'm just trying to figure out how many more I'd have to pick because we were getting paid less. And they were like, you know, why do you need this money? And I explained my mom's situation, and, you know, that we were poor, and I just kind of opened up to them, and they weren't judging. They were like, all right, it's going to be okay. It's going to be, they were making sure that I knew it was going to be okay. We'll figure something out. So the overseers came back and then yelled at us to get back to work. So I go back to the line, and I got my box next to me, and somebody came by and dumped a bunch of berries in there. Oh. And so it made me kind of pick up the pace. I realized people were, like, I had a team behind me. And I brought my first flat in, and they were like, you know, this isn't like, full enough. And somebody else was in line to, like, and they said, well, here, you know, take some, and they spread it out to make it a, kind of a full thing. It's almost bringing me to tears thinking about it, because it was such great gestures on their part.
What did you feel like when you saw these people that you didn't know helping you?
It was strange because I felt sorry for them when I saw them downtown and when I knew their situation. They were talking about where they slept outdoors, and it was kind of cold, and I was like pitying their situation. And here are these people that had nothing, literally, and were just making subsistence money, were like taking care of me. The embarrassment faded quickly. I was honored that I was brought into the group and looked over by people that other people ignore on the streets. Mm. And people, I'd been running around as like in a little street brat on Beacon Hill in Chinatown, and just really never noticed these people. I ended up not only meeting my mother's required quota, but they helped me exceed it. Mm. You know, my mother had said, you know, whatever you make over this, you can keep. And it was her incentive, like, and you're not just doing this to cover this woman's present and card, you know what I mean? Because that's what I was doing. But on the bus ride home, you know, it was a little more exuberant. Everyone, you know, got off and had some money, and they invited me to go along. And I was like, no, I have to get this money home, kind of thing. I didn't know that the banks were closed, or my mom, you know, I thought she needed it right away. And I was able to take the bus home, which was nice because it's all uphill from Pioneer Square up to Beacon Hill. It kind of changed my feeling about the situation that your grandmother was in, or that we were in collectively. It was like I had a different perspective of our poverty in relationship to these people that had helped us with what we went through. So when I got home, she asked me how it was. I really didn't like it. It was hard work. The men were mean that were the overseers. But I didn't want her to feel real bad about it, and I said it was okay. You know, I kind of put a good spin on it and told her how, you know, people fed me and how they were nice to me and they were kids. But I made it sound too good and try not to make her feel bad. She said, well, that's great. Then you can go back tomorrow. And I was like, yeah, that's when I kind of broke down and said it was awful and the men were mean. And I kind of told her more of the story. But she said, well, the people were nice, but we were in such a situation that, you know, she thought that it was, you know, a sacrifice I could occasionally make. I'll never forget what those people did for me. It's guided me on how I treat people. And
did your experience at the Berry Farm change the way you treated your own mother?
It made me more understanding of the situation that she was in and that we didn't really have that network of support that these people did, that they came together and they sat down and shared food. And my mother, who came out of a, you know, I'd say a middle or upper middle class family in Ballard, you know, Scandinavian neighborhood, to find herself raising kids on her own in the projects and public housing of South Seattle, where it was kind of looked down upon because of all the different minority groups that we lived around. We were teased a lot about it, that it's like people abandoned her. And I realized that if we were going to have anyone supporting us, it wasn't going to be our family members with means or former friends with means, that we were sort of in this with our neighbors and the people that were around us that were in the same situation.
Nemo Sayeru told that story to his daughter, Lala Andrea. StoryCorps at New Holly was produced by Ross Reynolds. You can hear this collection again at our website, kuow.org/speakersforum, and you'll find links to more stories at our website. Just search for StoryCorps. And that's it for this episode of Speakers Forum from KUOW 94.9 Seattle. Tune in again soon.